Snow falling in the towering Wasatch Mountains is the main source of water for most of the farms and cities in northern and central Utah. Eventually, much of it winds up in the Great Salt Lake. But in recent years, even through some wet years, that hasn't been enough to keep the lake from shrinking. As the water level drops, more and more of the lake bed is exposed. Dust from the dry lake bed blows into the cities of the Wasatch Front, causing air quality problems. Concern about the state of the Great Salt Lake has led to several multi-million dollar efforts to maintain and increase the water flowing to the lake and to the appointment of a Great Salt Lake Commissioner, Brian Steed.
When you look at the various ways which agriculture interacts with Great Salt Lake, I think that we can all agree that we're all in this together. And as agriculture flourishes, we can actually have a vibrant agriculture community as well as a vibrant Great Salt Lake. They're not mutually exclusive.
On the eastern side of Utah, the final destination for water flowing out of our mountains is the Colorado River. Tributaries to the river support agriculture and communities from Vernal to Blanding, and the river itself is at the heart of a system that supports millions of people in cities and thousands of farms through seven states and into Mexico. Utah uses its share of the water, but sends most of it downriver through Lake Powell and into the lower basin states. To manage its interests in the Colorado River, the state created the Colorado River Authority of Utah. Mark Stilson is its principal engineer.
What I've seen in terms of how the Farm Bureau helps is they provide that organization where farmers can talk and they can share methodologies and they can share, hey, here's what I'm doing and here's where we're headed in terms of making improvements.
Welcome to Cows, Plows, and Things That Grow, the Utah Farm Bureau podcast. I'm Dan Bomas. In a previous episode of Cows, Plows, and Things That Grow, we looked at how the state's water optimization program can help to save water on the level of individual farms. Today, we're looking at the much larger scale of how agricultural water use can help preserve these major features of the landscape. First, we'll hear from Mark Stilson with the Colorado River Authority of Utah. He tells us farmers have been working for generations to help preserve the water resources in that part of the state and to meet Utah's obligation to downstream users.
It used to be Emery County was all flood irrigation. And over the course of the last few decades, they have transitioned to sprinkler irrigation, which has saved an incredible amount of water and has really helped those producers, ag producers, weather the drought conditions that we're facing currently.
There's a worry that a lot of water users have that as they conserve, they're harming their own interests because it's a use it or lose it proposition under Western water law. You have to put your water allocation, your water rights to beneficial use, or eventually you could lose them. So how has the law been changing to accommodate those interests?
Okay, great question. So in Emery County, if you did a irrigation improvement project back in the 90s and you saved a bunch of water, there was no way to quantify that and show that on the water right. So the law has changed so that today, if you participate in an ag optimization type program, you can quantify those water savings and actually list it and keep that on the water right. And then the law now would allow you to utilize those savings and do something with them.
Can those farmers who are saving those water allocations, what can they do with them? Can they lease them? Can they sell them? Can they just hang on to them for the future?
Great question. So there's a couple different ways you can utilize those savings. A lot of ag producers, when they improve their systems, and as irrigation companies improve their systems, they're saving water, which means they are getting the benefit of longer seasons, better crop yields, which means more money in their pocket as an ag producer. You can also, based on what's happening now in the Colorado River Basin, and this is one of the programs that we're developing, is having the opportunity to lease that some of that saved water. You can lease it to other ag producers, or in terms of the program we're developing a program that you can lease the water to help the state of Utah meet our obligations under the 1922 Colorado River Compact.
We are obligated in Utah to deliver a particular share of water in the Colorado system to the downstream states.
That's correct. The 1922 Compact includes provision that the Upper Division states shall deliver 75 million acre feet over a 10-year running average. So that's the obligation we're under, and we've always met that obligation. We have always, for over 100 years, met our compact obligations to our downstream neighbors.
And those Upper Basin states include Utah, Wyoming, Colorado.
And New Mexico.
And New Mexico.
Yep.
New Mexico because of the San Juan River.
Uh-huh, yep.
And the Lower Basin states, California, Arizona, Nevada.
Correct.
These states are always talking about how much is mine and how much is yours and who's going to insist that we meet our obligations. What's going on with that process?
Okay, sure. That's a great question. So right now, if you look at the flow of the Colorado River, back when the compact was signed, that 20-year period was a very wet period, and the flow, the average flow was around 17 million acre feet. If you look at a 100-year record, from about 1900 to 2000, the average flow of the Colorado River at Lee Ferry, which is Lake Powell, is about just under 15 million acre feet. But from the year 2000 to 2023, the last 23 years, the average flow has dropped to around 12.5 million acre feet, which is obvious because you've seen Lake Powell and Lake Mead drained because the lower basin states have been living off of that storage during this drought period.
And that's where the potential conflict comes in and the need to develop a new agreement, possibly even replacing the 1922 compact?
So the agreement is not trying to replace the 1922 compact. It's not even changing the terms of the compact. It would be a temporary agreement that would allow the basin states to say, here's how we're going to operate over the next period of years. The last temporary agreement was 20 years, which expires in 2026. So this would be another temporary agreement that says, how can we operate in this drought period and still maintain the as much of the uses as we can that has been developed? So for Utah, what that means is we are doing our best to adapt and keep Utah farmers farming because we think that's important. It's vitally important that we keep local food production in Utah.
What's the role of the federal government in all this? Could they impose a solution when the states don't agree?
Yes. So they have asserted that they could. Now the states are like, hey, back off, we can do this.
Turning back to how farmers are operating in Utah, one of the concerns that they have is the salinity of the Colorado River. Two problems there is just that it's naturally occurring salt in the water that affects their operations. But second, the farmers here have an obligation to protect the water quality going downstream. How do they do that?
Okay, yes. So the U.S. entered into an agreement with Mexico to reduce the salt loading to the Colorado River. So again, being from Emery County, just sharing my experience, with flood irrigation, as that water travels across the land, it picks up a lot of salt. We have a lot of Manco Shelf, which is an old seabed formation, has a lot of salt in it. And flood irrigation will pick that salt up, and then there's a lot of return flow to the river. And that salt heads downstream and does damage downstream. So the federal government, through the Bureau of Reclamation and their Salinity Control Program, has put hundreds of millions of dollars into communities throughout the western states in the Colorado River Basin to switch from flood irrigation methods to more efficient sprinkler irrigation methods. Those type of methods keep the salts on the fields and help prevent the salts from being flushed down the river. So.
What role does a private organization like Farm Bureau play in bringing farmers together with other stakeholders to deal with the Colorado River?
Farm Bureau is an awesome organization helping farmers connect and learn from each other's experience. So what I've seen in terms of how the Farm Bureau helps is they provide that organization where farmers can talk and they can share methodologies and they can share, hey, here's what I'm doing and here's where we're headed in terms of making improvements and doing the best we can to, you know, adapt to the situation we're facing. So.
And also representing them at the legislature where a good bit of the money for this optimization effort is coming from.
You bet. You bet they have a very powerful voice that they can present to our legislature saying, hey, ag is important. We need to focus on and protect our ability to grow food here locally.
When other residents of Utah who are not involved in agriculture think about the future of the Colorado River, what do they need to know?
That's a big question. There's a lot to know. But the main thing to understand is that we are just in a very difficult drought period. And so as we adapt, as we learn to become more efficient, and we are. The Utah farmers are a great group of folks. They have adapted and they're continuing to adapt to continue to do what they do to make a living and put food on Utah tables and tables throughout the West. So.
Do you see agriculture growing, production growing in the Colorado River drainage in the basin?
It depends what you mean by that, because there are definitely agriculture producers who are growing their operations and doing more even with less water. So in that sense, yes, we are seeing some very innovative approaches to producing food. And so those type of operations and growth is definitely happening. The main thing that is, and the key sticking point is simply the fact that we don't have the water supply that we wish we had. Neither basin, neither upper basin nor lower basin has the volume of water that they wish they had or have had historically to do what we've done. And so as we recognize that and grapple with that fact, how we, you know, which state and which water users cut back and how they do it is the key point that we're working on right now and negotiating as how that happens. And for Utah, what we're doing is trying to make as soft a landing as possible in terms of helping farmers become more efficient, better at doing what they're doing with less water.
Mark Stilson is the principal engineer of the Colorado River Authority of Utah. Cows, plows, and things that grow will be back in just a moment.
Attention, Utah Farm Bureau members. We've partnered with Abenity to offer you a bigger and better member benefits platform. With Abenity, you'll get access to all your favorite Farm Bureau discounts, plus thousands of new savings opportunities at over a million locations across the U.S. and Canada. Whether you're planning a trip, shopping, dining out, or enjoying local attractions, savings are just a tap away. Download the app today and start saving instantly. Learn more about utahfarmbureau.org/member benefits. Utah Farm Bureau and Abenity, your gateway to exclusive perks.
You're listening to Cows, Plows, and Things That Grow, the Utah Farm Bureau podcast. Brian Steed is Utah's first Great Salt Lake Commissioner, coordinating a multi-agency effort to preserve the lake. He was appointed to that position by Governor Spencer Cox after serving as the director of the Utah Department of Natural Resources and as chief of staff to Congressman Chris Stewart. He's also on the faculty of Utah State University.
What's the actual danger of losing the Great Salt Lake? And by that, we should define what we're talking about. I guess the entire lake water drying up. I mean, is that actually even possible, or what would it mean to lose the lake?
So we don't see it likely that the Great Salt Lake would ever actually entirely dry up. I mean, you have large water bodies flowing in from Bear River, from Weaver River, from Jordan River, We expect that to continue. What you do see, however, is the lake getting smaller. And as the lake gets smaller, you have a series of events that happen. First of all, that water, as it gets more concentrated, gets more salty. And as it gets more salty, you lose a lot of the biological integrity of the lake. And that means you have less brine shrimp and everybody's favorite critter, brine flies. But that also means you end up with having less migratory birds and other things that come through there, and that's a problematic. Perhaps touching your listeners here, as we have a smaller lake, we actually have less water in the system. And what's weird about that, there was a recent study at Utah State that said for summer precipitation, if we were to do away or have a much smaller lake, we would have a 50% reduction in precipitation regionally. That's a big deal. And for someone that, you know, monitors water pretty carefully, that would be a big impact. For snowpack, similarly, you'd have a big effect. And then air quality issues. A smaller lake has more exposed lake bed. As that lake bed remains exposed, then you have air quality issues that happen. You have dust that kicks up. That dust often has minerals in it. And in other terminal saline lakes that you've seen around the world, say like the Aral Sea, one of the real impacts has been that dust has ended up on farmers' fields, also impairing how much crop they can grow. So there's really this cascade of events we'd like to avoid. Aside from people don't generally like breathing dust, it's not healthy for them. And so there's just this cascade of events that we would like to stop.
When you look at the role that agriculture plays in preserving the Great Salt Lake, a lot of course, upstream diversion of water, but there's also a lot of return flow out of farms to the lake. But what, in your mind, is the biggest issue that agriculture has to think about as the state looks to protect the lake?
I mean, I think it's twofold. I think it would be, I think farmers are phenomenal stewards of the land. And I think that no one cares more about landscapes than farmers do. I mean, my grandfather was a farmer to the day he died. And I can tell you, he didn't ever make a lot of money on that. In fact, he always took other jobs. But he perceived himself first in that role. And he farmed right on the shores of Great Salt Lake, incidentally, in Syracuse, and produced great onions, for the record. We miss getting those for Christmas. The issue with the lake going away is that then there is also this event that happens to where you have other interest take part. Let's say you have a lot of bird species that become more scarce. There are federal mechanisms, say the Endangered Species Act, that comes into play and says, hey, we're now going to reorder based on federal law water rights. That should scare everybody. And so there's already been a listing petition for one species called the Wilson phalarope, and we very much want to avoid that listing petition from being successful. The best way we can avoid that is by having a healthier ecosystem. In addition to that, I mean, I think that when you look at the various ways which agriculture interacts with Great Salt Lake, I think that we can all agree that we're all in this together. And as agriculture flourishes, we can actually have a vibrant agriculture community as well as a vibrant Great Salt Lake. They're not mutually exclusive, and I'd like to see more of that commonality and working together going forward.
When you talk to farmers, what do they tell you about the lake?
I think it depends on the farmer. I mean, some people view it as a real concern and as a real need. I think others that are just really concerned about day-to-day, right? And they perceive that if this is, you know, a threat to my livelihood, if people perceive that for some reason this is that zero-sum game where I, as the Great Salt Lake Commissioner, are going to come for your water, then that's a threat. The reality is we're not playing that way. We're trying very hard to work together to make sure that there's win-win solutions. So, and I think it's going to take generally a reevaluation of how we use water. You know, some of those things that we've come to realize that water being used most efficiently in agriculture may actually not be always returning that flow to the lake. So being mindful of that exchange is going to be really important.
So what other issues do farmers need to think about as they approach the lake? We have one really ugly water-sucking invasive plant, Phragmites, Is that relevant to lake management and agriculture?
Absolutely. So one of the things, we need to view this holistically. The Phragmites problem is real. And we are very interested in making sure that we can reduce the amount of Phragmites around the lake. Interestingly, ag has been one of the solutions to that Phragmites problem by grazing cattle. And cattle actually do eat the frag, and having that happen, I think, has been to the benefit of both the lake as well as the farmer. Generally, though, we do need to make sure that we reduce the amount of those water-sucking plants, make sure that more water gets to the lake from those non-native invasive things like Phragmites.
So how about changes in evolution in water law? In recent years, there have been some modifications that allow farmers to hang on to their water rights, even when they're conserving the total amount of water. How much is that helping?
I think it helps a lot. And I think that Western water law has set up to be use it or lose it, as long as you're putting it to beneficial use. We've actually expanded that description of beneficial use in Utah to include other things, like temporary leases for that water to Great Salt Lake, and we're trying to find farmers and ranchers that might be interested in a voluntary lease program. We can make it financially worthwhile to them. And that's one of those things that's a win-win, especially when we're dealing with the volatility in ag markets right now. I know that we've had, you know, alfalfa has gone up in price and gone down in price, and trying to find a way to help ag be more resilient while continuing to be really beneficial to the state, I think is really great.
As we learn more about how to conserve water and seeing the evolution of water rights, how does that affect somebody in, say, the Sevier Basin or Iron County or places that don't directly impact the lake?
So I think that's a really important distinction. And I think it's important for people to understand that not everywhere in the state is the Great Salt Lake drainage. And so we are talking about, when I talk about my job, we're talking about the Great Salt Lake Basin. That being said, the experiments that we're doing in Great Salt Lake Basin will actually have impacts other places. So, for instance, we've invested a lot of money in agricultural optimization. That agricultural optimization in Great Salt Lake was really trying to figure out how we can best use water in a way that benefits the farmers as well as take some of that saved water and get it to Great Salt Lake. In the Sevier system, it's been so scarce all the time, right? And trying to make sure that more farmers are able to access more water, I think, is something that's a different concern in the Sevier system. But that same tool, agricultural optimization, can be applied in the Sevier system in a way that benefits those farmers and ranchers as well.
Are we putting a lot of pressure on farmers when some similar pressure needs to be put on municipal and industrial water?
I mean, I think that's a really good point as well. We cannot solve the Great Salt Lake's issues on the back of ag alone. We absolutely need to work with municipalities. And when you look at where municipalities are growing right now, as well as how water is being used in municipalities, that's going to be a big key. Think about this just for a second. We have about 150,000 acres of sodgrass in the Great Salt Lake Basin. If we watered that sodgrass, that's just people's turf, right? People's yards. If we watered that, what that turf needs to be watered versus what people think it needs to be watered, it's reducing that amount of watering by about a third. If we did that in the Great Salt Lake Basin, we're talking about 110,000 acre feet of water being saved per year. That's a huge amount of water, 110,000 acre feet. And so if we can do that, that gets us a long ways to saving Great Salt Lake without even talking about agriculture.
Do we need to send everybody to water school?
Yes, I think we should. I think that would be a good use of everyone's time. No, in truth, I think that people have to understand that water is a scarce resource that always has been in the West. How we use water is going to be really important for how we live here in the West. And there's room for actually having a vibrant communities, vibrant agriculture, and a vibrant ecosystem. But that's got to be intentional. We've got to make sure that we're working together to get those ends.
Who should agriculture producers be listening to as they make their plans for water use? I mean, the world is changing. Everybody knows that. Farmers know that. But who should they be listening to as they plan ahead?
So I think that it's important to work with people that are being innovative. I've really appreciated working with the Utah Farm Bureau and kind of the forward thinking that they are participating in to see that they can get solutions for real scarcity issues today. Interestingly, living in the West, we know that there's always going to be some variability in the amount of water that's available. The Farm Bureau has been really, really good at getting solutions to farmers. I also really appreciate working with some of my colleagues in the academic community that have done some good work on trying to find out how we have better, you know, water savings in crop management, how we have better savings in how we irrigate, and all those kind of innovations I think are really important.
What are farmers doing now that is benefiting the lake and contributing to its future?
So I've been really impressed by farmers' response on the ag optimization program itself. Supply has been limited on the amount of resources that are available. Demand has far outstripped that supply of the financial resource for ag optimization. And if you look at that, that shows that farmers and ranchers are really concerned about how they use their water. They're really concerned about being innovative. They're really concerned about making sure that they are able to have those adaptive solutions, and I really appreciate that. I will also say that I have been truly, I mean, I feel really lucky in my job to get to work with the ag community so closely, because I find that I have friends there. I find that I've got people that I can work together, finding common solutions, and I think that that's been really, I mean, it's really been really nice, and it's been really humbling. I mean, I think agriculture is one of the hardest jobs that can ever be done. It's not easy, and it's always hard in a state that's as dry as Utah to make those ends meet. What I found in the ag community, though, are people that are gracious and willing to engage and willing to face hard problems and to work together to solve them.
Has anything really surprised you since you got this job that you didn't expect to learn?
So I can tell you that I've worked in the natural resources space, but I was never like super passionate about the Great Salt Lake. This is not something that I was like gonna die for. And I'm still like trying to be rational about it. But I will say I've become more emotionally attached to Great Salt Lake issues than I thought I would. And I also think that that looking at the benefits of Great Salt Lake, I see that there are high costs in losing it.
Take us through the worst case scenario then.
So worst case scenario is we continue on our trajectory where we're delivering less water to the lake, and as a result of that, the lake gets smaller and smaller. That creates a negative feedback loop to where then we have less snowpack, we have more dust events, we also have more dust on snow, and so we have faster runoff. And that's all those things kind of create a negative system to where I think there's less water to go around. It creates more of a Hunger Games scenario to where then you've got, you know, the cities going out and saying we need to be predatory, we need to get water from someplace else because we're having less water from our natural reaches. So we have less water in coming down, you know, Big Cottonwood Canyon or wherever else. And if that's the case, I think that there are going to be kind of more conflicts. I think we can avoid those conflicts. And I think we can avoid those conflicts by just being a little more active in how we manage water going forward.
And what's the rosy future? If we do things right, what can we expect?
Well, I think that Utah has been a trendsetter. I mean, interestingly, when I talk water law with my colleagues in the West, people are surprised on how well we are doing given the amount of, you know, uncertainty that we have out there. And so I think that the best case scenario is we work together. We find common solutions and we find places that work in the very Utah way. And I'm absolutely convinced that we can do better than we have done. I'm also absolutely convinced that ag is part of the solution. And so working together with ag so we have vibrant communities and vibrant agriculture economies and we have a vibrant ecology, all those things I think can happen. And to me, that's the goal we're working for.
Brian Steed is the Great Salt Lake Commissioner, the first to hold that title in Utah, working with multiple state and federal agencies to help protect the Great Salt Lake. We also heard from Mark Stilson, the principal engineer with the Colorado River Authority of Utah. We're always anxious to hear from you with your feedback on the podcast and your ideas for future episodes. You can reach us through the website at utahfarmbureau.org. You've been listening to Cows, Plows, and Things That Grow from the Utah Farm Bureau. Our mission is to inspire all Utah families to connect, succeed, and grow through the miracle of agriculture. I'm Dan Bomas. We hope you'll join us again soon.